Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we need to continue our appeal to heaven. Got to remember, this goes all the way back to Israel. This goes back to England. This goes back to most nations that at least have the Word of God, that when they are being oppressed, then they appeal to heaven to seek justice. So the recipe is continue to learn, pray, and act, because as we understand better, the more we can fine-tune, identify what we need in our prayers, or we need to say, or need to appeal. So what this show is really about, or the movement that we're trying to ignite, is full compliance of the Constitution. It's not just that they take an oath. It's not about just Article 6. Oh, well, they take this oath. They're supposed to support the Constitution. Therefore, that's it. No, we actually have to connect the dots. If they take that oath, which they're legally obligated, if they're not, then they should be removed because they're obligated to take that oath. Now that they're under oath, we have the ability to hold them accountable by using First Amendment petitions. I don't know why anybody that focuses just on Article 6 is missing the whole point, because we need to get you to do your job. They're supposed to do their job. And if they're not doing their job, then what happens? So is it really focus on Article 6? Or maybe it's more focus on the First Amendment, because we need to be invigorated. We need to be upset. We need to be livid. We need to be in their grill, poking them in the eye if they refuse to fulfill their legally required oath, which is to support the Constitution. When you say support, folks, that doesn't mean that you're going to vote properly. That means that you are a guardian. You're a warrior in the ranks of warriors, and you have enemies among you. Those who are doing things that are direct violations of the Constitution, public servants are required to call them out, because they're supposed to be supporting the Constitution. See, this support is an active support. I see this all the time. There's such a thing as passive support, like a supporting wall. It's just passive. It just sits there. But the support that Madison talks about regarding that very specific word is an active word. They're to act like an immune system. They're to attack anything foreign that doesn't belong, anything that is taking the government or a person doing things that they are directly violating their oath. This is why they're supposed to be doing this. If they don't do it, then we have to do it, and that's the First Amendment, right? So what do you do when there's honor amongst thieves? Then we have to break down that honor and that code and start replacing every single one of them. And we need to actually make sure that those that we replace are going to be willing and demanding to be held accountable. We need champions on the Constitution, not champions of agendas. Therefore, we also have to demand that they implement the enforcement of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. There's the three dots there, folks. The oath, holding them accountable by using petitions for the redress of grievances. And then the third final dot is demanding that they be removed, or they remove those who are violating their oath by failing to support the Constitution, or those who are directly violating it. Because remember, Section 3 calls out those people who give aid and comfort. Aid and comfort means they allow them to persist in their insurrection against the Constitution, in their violations. This is why I look at Congress. All of Congress needs to go. Because there's not one person that's actually poking everybody in the eye and taking the high road of saying, you're all violating the Constitution. Not one of you deserves to be in here. the Constitution and this republic being a republic that is based on the rule of law, and that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, Section 3 is a part of that supreme law, which means it must be abided by. This is why we don't cherry-pick just Article 6. This is why we actually create this symbiotic relationship between Article 6's oath, the First Amendment petition, the right of petition, the redress of grievances, and Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. What we need to actually start poking people that say, oh, Article 6. We need to start help invigorating people to really embrace the entire Constitution. It is those people who want to, you know, isolate a part of the Constitution that are really a part of the problem. And I meet people all the time that they don't even know they're being manipulated in that way, because they're working with an organization that's supporting this concept of Article 6. Yeah, we believe it's about Article 6, not Article 5. Right? There's those folks out there with the convention. Oh, it's about Article 5. No, it's about Article 6. No, it's about the entire Constitution. End of story. Let's move forward. We do need to get into, and I actually want to finish out that public lands acts, those acts we were covering. But I got moved into a different direction, and so I thought I'd rant a little bit. And so I need to end this. The reality is that there are people in the Patriot movement that have created this romantic paradigm of American legal system, American government, and so forth, that really appeals to the Christian-hearted patriots, which is predominantly most of them. So it is not a romantic thing. It is about the law. And there are those who kind of create this mystic, I'll just say this mystic romantic picture of common law. I hear people teaching people about common law that it's God's law. That common law, because common law is a legal system. And the legal system has basically been rooted, and it goes back. But there are people that tell you it has been the legal system from Israel through Europe. That's not true. As a matter of fact, as we, being the ancestors, or our government being the ancestors of the British government, we need to kind of look at the real story about Britain and the real story about Christianity. So when we look at the British history, Britain was a pagan nation during the time of Christ. Shortly after Christ died, they became, not enslaved, but they became a part of, because they were conquered by the Roman Empire. And that was around 43 AD, so about a decade after Christ passed. About that. And so they became a part of the political union of the Roman Empire. Now, there was Christianity that was all separate, because at that point in time, Rome worshipped Ra. No, hold it. Ra. And they had their gods and so forth. And it wasn't until, I think, 300 and something AD, 320, 330, Constantine had an epiphany. And this is when Constantine basically embraced the Christianity in Christ and said, we're going to make the Roman Church a Christian church. And we're going to, you know, take this Christianity in Christ, and we're going to establish a world doctrine. Because at this point in time, Rome was controlling the world. It was the world empire. So it started to establish this Roman Catholic Church. Now, it wasn't much longer, maybe another century plus, when Rome finally fell, and it no longer had the military control over the world. However, it did have religious control, because even though Rome fell, the Roman Catholic Empire rose up and basically started managing and controlling government. How were they controlling government? They were coronating kings. They were manipulating and managing the government and dictating what the laws of religion were to be and the behavior of people. Now, you've heard me talk about Martin Luther, but I don't want to skip down that path. What I want to do is actually start talking about the legal system of Britain. Because at this point in time, Britain was basically, it was a pagan nation when it was captured. It was still a pagan nation until the Roman Catholic Church was established. And that's when Britain got religion. And so as they started going down this path, it wasn't until the 7th century that they started realizing, hey, you know what, we need to change our legal system. Because at that point in time, nations were free to have their own legal systems, but they had to have the church. And so it was basically, I think it's the 6th century when Britain picked up the Anglo-Saxon legal system. And they maintained their monarch or theocracy with this Anglo-Saxon legal system. And it wasn't really till, I think, somewhere around the 11th century, 1066, if I'm correct, this is when they broke away from the Anglo-Saxon legal system and established common law. Now, there's many people that will tell you that Britain was a common law nation from the beginning, that common law was, you know, had this ancestry that goes all the way back to Moses and before, that it's always been the law. Well, there's no evidence of that. And as a matter of fact, we can see how literally nations were ebbing and flowing in different directions. But Britain established common law in the 11th century. And you're being told, or there's this, again, the romantic picture is the Bible was the basis of common law. Now, that's not true. So the Bible didn't exist. The only people that had the Bible were the clergy of the church, and maybe the king or what have you, or he had his own clergy to, you know, to tell him and so forth. But there may have been this symbiotic relationship that the king wanted, or the monarchs wanted to have this tie, because if you have a harmony with the people's religion, then the people follow you. But if you start breaking away from that, then, you know, they start resisting, and you just start creating, you know, I'll just call it civil unrest, rioting, protests, even revolutions come from that. And most monarchs prefer to maintain power than, you know, destroy their kingdoms. So the epoch for Britain to truly change its direction was really 1215. This was when they had the Magna Carta, when the 25 land barons actually drew swords on the king and basically said, either you recognize the rights of Englishmen and stop oppressing us, or we will behead you right here and now, and we will hold the next monarch accountable. You got to remember the paradigm. See, the paradigm that was cast in stone, that was established from the Roman Catholic Church and the Roman Empire, and then became the Roman Catholic Empire, the concept was that men were anointed by God to lead their nations, which means that nobody dared actually think that, you know, somebody could take that honor by themselves. It was this divine right of this hereditary line. And so this is why the children of kings, because that family line was sacred. At least that was the paradigm. And even Hobbes basically supported that in, I believe his book was called Leviathan. It wasn't until John Locke back in the 1600s, in responding to Hobbes, that no, these men are just like us. They're not. This concept of we being subjects to kings because they've been anointed by God is just a fallacy. That's when those paradigms started changing. But in 1215, this is when the king, basically with the land barons, created this really romantic thing. Now, I cover this probably once a year. I go through this once a year. And this is when the land barons created the Magna Carta, And the king basically established these 25 counties, these 25 geographical areas that the land barons, the areas that they controlled, they would be the governors of that land and basically be the first in the chain of command for the people in their area, their land. And so what the king ended up doing, or the monarchy, it was a very slow process, but they ended up migrating these land barons in establishing a royalty to these families. And this is where the dukes and princes and so forth started, you know, coming to be. And the king did this so that there was no longer a hereditary tie to really that land, that these people were just elevated into a royal status. And eventually, the king appointed sheriffs. Now, going back to the common law in the 11th century, the way common law worked was the king appointed judges. These were like a magistrate that would actually establish a standard of the law, and based on that, you know, what the punishments were and those types of things. If you really look at, to me, the real big difference between common law and civil law, common law is a legal system that takes you to a point of justice. It is the best system to ensure justice is being held and being attained. Now, civil law goes well beyond the justice. It actually gets into punitive. In other words, the courts are weaponized, and the juries and so forth could basically take everything you had, which as a punitive measure, let's say your coffee was too hot and it burned some old lady's lamp. And instead of actually paying for her medical and loss of wages, you know, the things that she actually lost, they go after them because, oh, you knew it was way too hot and soak them for millions of dollars. That's civil law. America never incorporated civil law. Actually, I take that back. All 50 states, you know, incorporated their own law. 49 of them incorporated common law as the law of the land. Now, I believe that case for the coffee was not in Louisiana, because Louisiana is the only state that established civil law. And yet today, folks, every state has civil law, even though they declared common law. The whole point of this diatribe is to help you realize what we were supposed to have and how it came to be. Because we evolved away from the British monarchical theocracy of common law and came into the land of constitutional republics. So as we kind of go through and getting back to the Magna Carta, this is when everything shifted, because, like I said, it was an epoch. This is when Britain established a republic. A republic being a representative government in some ways. The king was still the king. He was still the sovereign. However, the people created the House of Commons, and the aristocracy created the House of Lords. Interestingly enough, as we kind of look at it, the aristocracy was really more in control of Parliament, and we covered this just recently in the ratification debates. So the fact of the matter is that England started migrating, and they were evolving, and they were still evolving, because they actually, once they created Parliament, and once they, you know, established this common law system in the 11th century, everything was moving forward. Well, things started shifting, and it wasn't, you know, it was through the Tudor period, because the Tudor period was they called Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, or Queen Mary, Bloody Mary, because she was a despot. As we look at the coming out of the Tudor period and the point of Martin Luther, the early 15th century, news traveled quickly around Europe that the Germanic states broke away from the Roman Empire. Now, Britain was, you know, they're kind of separate. They had the islands, so you had to, you know, to get to them, you had to get on ships to get there. And I don't think the Roman Catholic Empire commanded a navy at the time. So when King Henry decided to get a divorce, this is when he chose to create a theocracy that was British unique, because he wanted a divorce, because the Catholic Church wouldn't let him have one. It wasn't because he was trying to reform Christianity. It wasn't because he was trying to take the people closer to Christ and closer to the Bible, because actually what was happening in the Germanic states, the way the Germanic states were capable of breaking away, was that Martin Luther actually printed the Bible to prove to the people that the Catholic Church was, you know, a bunch of hypocrites. So as we look at King Henry, he made this epoch. He just wanted the convenience, and he got away with it. And he started the establishment of the Anglican Church or the Episcopal Church. As this moved forward, and I'm just summarizing here, so this is really editorializing and kind of paraphrasing, but as this moved forward, there had to become this new theocracy. And so instead of having a pope, they had the Archbishop of Canterbury. And the Archbishop of Canterbury was the grand poobah of the Episcopal Church. Now, when you really think about it, and you look at, you know, Christ's kingdom, prophets, and so forth, you know, it was just like completely void of those types of things that you learn from the Bible. But nevertheless, as this movement, because it took almost a century, for England to actually create its own theocracy, because it took King James the effort to actually assemble academics or scholars of the Bible to write the King James Bible. Now that they actually had a Bible to put in everybody's hands, now they had a theocracy. And interestingly enough, King James, his interest was ensuring the accuracy of the Bible. Because this is when the Bible became the basis of law in England. Now, as that became, you know, the kind of like that foundation of their law, they went back and forth. And if you remember, because I cover this every Christmas, I believe it was Cromwell that basically outlawed the winter wildings and so forth in the early 16th century. And with some help from, I think, Dutch or somewhere else, they wanted to basically, you know, expel Cromwell. So what ended up happening is there was this big revolution. It was called the Glorious Revolution, where people could be free to enjoy their pagan holidays. Interestingly enough, in other words, as England had made itself more Christ-like, or they tried to be more biblically based, there was this big revolution to maintain paganism as well. What really ended up happening from King Henry, even through King James, and this establishment of the Episcopal Church and this monarchical theocracy, what really happened was there were so many different people that thought differently that factions were created, and England became a hotbed of instability. There were always these problems of people being oppressed because their religion was an Anglican. And that's where the Puritans, and this is why in the 1600s, when the Americas started opening up, people actually started looking at that as an opportunity for religious freedom to get away from the king's army. And so that's exactly what happened. The Puritans, and everybody knows the stories of the migrations. England was a hotbed of problems because of how they evolved. They've always been a hotbed, and they've always been, I would just say, right in the center of real global catastrophes, like the drug pushing, the opium pushing in China. So I'm going to be going into a break here, but when we come back, I'll get then into how common law was established based on the Bible with this new, monarchical theocracy of England, and we'll come back and we'll actually talk about really briefly this doctrine of the lesser magistrate, the doctrine of magistrates, and so we'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Now, there's something interesting about England, because what was happening in England was really what was happening in Europe. What I mean by that is because the king mandated to get away from the Catholic Church, and there were people that were still stuck with the Catholic Church, or they were fixed in their paradigm. There were those that were fixed with this new romantic church, you know, the sycophants of the crown. There were people that wanted more of the Protestant faith. That's right, there are three factions. This new faith, this Reformation that came from Germany. Three factions already right now in England, as I've just kind of covered the top of this. There were even new factions, the Puritans, those types of people, that started creating their own, you know, deviation on how salvation would be obtained for themselves. The whole point is that in Europe, nations were warring with each other because their doctrines were different. They hated each other because as they broke away, very similar to what happened in America. The Puritans, because they were so intolerant, they actually forced two states to be created. Rhode Island, Connecticut, and that is right. I believe they actually created three states. I believe Rhode Island was one, Connecticut, and New Hampshire. As people started teaching apostasy or going against what was acceptable, they were banished to the north, banished to the south, and they kind of created this new religious state. So the fact of the matter is, as we start looking at England and how it got to this boiling, it went into a revolution. And at this point in time, the king had already kind of created the doctrine of magistrates, because remember going back to the counts were elevated into royalty. This gave the king the opportunity to select sheriffs to govern the land and collect taxes. This was a position of nobility. This usually was a pretty much independent man who, you know, had been, you know, elevated in status, because in England, the ability to really own land was very, very limited. So the sheriff was usually a person that, you know, had more land than others and was a well-to-do, and actually, he was a person that the king believed would basically follow him. And so the king created this aside from the common law system that gave the people the ability to petition. Because what ended up happening under the Magna Carta, the land barons were those representatives that would champion the king in petitioning, that would champion the land baron or that count to petition the king. That shifted over to the magistrate, or I should say the sheriff. In addition to the sheriff, the king still had his judges when it came to the court, when it came to violations of the law. Now, when people felt that the law was becoming too oppressive, like they were passing laws and enforcing laws that would take away the people's ability to go into the forest and hunt for food or scavenge for food and to survive. Their fundamental right of survival was being challenged, and actually the king was doing, you know, very dangerous, oppressive things that would cause revolts. So the people had a mechanism based on the Magna Carta as well as the Bill of Rights to petition the king. Now, because they really weren't representative when it came to the king, I mean, they could talk to their person in that in Commons, in the House of Commons, but their hands were tied. They could only do certain things. So they had to basically petition, and the sheriff was the one that would actually grant that right. And there were these mechanisms. If the sheriff wouldn't, then the people, based on the Glorious Bill of Rights as well as the Magna Carta, the people had the ability to assemble, organize themselves, and petition the king through this, what we call a temporary provisional government, until the problems were redressed with the people and the king. So this could be done in a myopic, in other words, in one or two counties, or it could be done throughout the kingdom if the king was being too oppressive. Now, the smart kings, you know, they only picked on certain people. They only picked on, you know, certain areas of the kingdom, because if you pick on everybody, then everybody hates you. So they were really, I mean, if there was a nation that was, you know, brought up in centuries of dubiousness and evil and, you know, ways of tyranny and so forth, I would think that when we look at it, obviously the empires that controlled the world, you know, Egypt, Rome, and so forth, they learned how to be very dubious. But I would think also theocracies like Israel, as well as all of these other theocracies. And I can see how England was literally learning from everybody how to do, I'll just say, very evil manipulations and so forth. So anyway, when we came to America, these concepts were being established. Some, and we covered this, and they actually identified, I think, in both Massachusetts and Virginia, there may have been another debate where they talked about the differences of government, the differences of the legal systems in the colonies. In other words, each colony was kind of its own little nation. However, it was a nation for the king. In other words, the king created a charter, and he allowed them to govern themselves on how they, you know, said that they would do those things. This is why in the 1760s, when the king started basically deciding he's going to extract the money out of the Americas to pay for his latest, you know, the last several decades of warring and so forth, he wanted to get on top of their finances. And when the Americans weren't going to take it, he made a big mistake. And I say he made a huge mistake because here's what was the whole point of doing this? He wanted to make money off of the American colonists. And so the American colonists pushed back and said, no taxation without representation. He could have paid his debts had he given the colonies representation. Now, there were some problems. Parliament, you know, had these physical constraints. You know, and they didn't want to give up their seats in this building. It was the same problem in America with Congress. In the early 1900s, Congress was already busting in the seams, or busting through their seams, of the physical layout of the House of Representatives and possibly the Senate. If you really look, they can only seat so many in that room. Now, technically, they could actually, because that room has a very high ceiling, they could create these balconies, and they could actually create more seats that way. And by dividing the states, you know, from the bottom, mid-tier, top, however they want to do it, and they could have changed the Capitol to accommodate more seats. But nobody wants to do that, and as a matter of fact, everybody recognizes that the more people to represent, the more power that representative gains. And so in England, this doctrine of magistrates was kind of established as one of the many different alternatives, and the ability of the people's right to create provincial governments. This is why we go through the Tory Acts. This is why, when we look at what happened in America, when they started oppressing the Americans in the 1763 and on, and the king started dismissing the colonist governments and establishing his own, the people did what Englishmen had the right to do. They used their rights of assembly, and they organized themselves into councils, conventions, assemblies, and or committees. There were different names in each of the states. They called themselves different, but they were doing the same thing. And so were they actually establishing, were they going to the sheriff? The doctrine of magistrates really wasn't that mechanism. The doctrine of magistrates was the mechanism of kind of protecting the people from those types of laws by not enforcing them and pushing back that way. But in this particular case, the people actually elected a body representative, a provincial Republican representative body, and then they started organizing petitions, and eventually all of these provincial governments throughout the colony created a state provincial government. That most all the states called those committees of correspondence. In other words, this new formation was getting to, you know, so as the states were not getting any relief, they weren't getting any relief. So what we got to organize to the next level. We got to start organizing the states or colonies as a single communication body. And this is where they started communicating amongst the states to, and the obvious thing was to create a Continental Congress. So when you look at how common law under England facilitated this movement, common law today still facilitates that movement because the Constitution still protects your right of assembly, your right of organizing, and your right of petitioning for the redress of grievances. That's precisely the mechanism of standing up to government. It is not convincing your legislature to call for a convention of states. It is not going into the courts, because we cover this all the time. The court's jurisdictions are tied and limited to only those things enumerated. In other words, the court's jurisdiction extends to all things in law and fact, or in, well, I always, because I know there's equity, and I always trip up how to precisely say this. So when we look at the jurisdiction shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution. So in other words, when it comes to the king or the government doing something that's not within the Constitution, like the Department of Energy or the Department of Transportation or Education or what have you, and they're starting to regulate these things, then this court has no jurisdiction. You don't go to the court over those things. You only go to the court over things like, hey, we have 40,000 people in our congressional district, and we're not supposed to exceed 30. It's time to create a whole new congressional district. Now, the Constitution kind of managed that by 10-year increments, because they only did censuses every 10 years. So if you busted through your seams, but you know, from one census to the next, you had to wait to the next census to get reapportioned. But the fact of the matter is, if you don't get reapportioned, then you have a right to actually go to the court, because this is in their jurisdiction. Does it arise under the Constitution? Do you understand that? If it's in the Constitution, then you need to go to the court to get the government to do what they're supposed to be doing. We made the mistake of going into the court over things they had no business being involved in, such as the Scopes trial with the, you know, the monkey trial. They had no jurisdiction over education. And this is where the states basically should have actually maintained it. And when they tried to appeal it to the federal court, hold on here. This is about education. That doesn't arise under the Constitution. The federal court has no jurisdiction, period. But we allowed this. Why? Because everybody became a part, our entire lawyers and the complete legal system consolidated nationally to make sure that things would drive into the federal courts. Because all the lawyers were taught that's what you got to do. And that's why it became this money racket. So, as we go through this evolution, even America evolved. We evolved away from the monarchical theocracy and the doctrines of magistrates. We created, by divine inspiration, a new form of government that gave us checks and balances, not just a single check such as the magistrates. We had bicameral legislative bodies that kept each other in check. We also had, you know, the separations of powers, because the courts could only do this, executives could only do this, and legislatures could only do this. So there were this magnitude of different checks and balances, and within the Constitution, the greatest check was with we the people. Because we the people were the only entity that could be used to enforce the federal laws. That's why the Constitution requires that Congress call forth the militia to execute the laws. Now, Congress started violating that by creating all of these new enforcement agencies, which was a direct violation of the militia. There was never a design to allow, as a matter of fact, when we went through, and I got to go back through the Virginia ratification dates, because I told you I was going to do this. Because if you really read through there, they actually talk about the shenanigans when the king was able to enforce his own laws by having his own, you know, army to actually do that. They said, we can't allow the army to be able to, or the king, or this government to enforce their own laws. They must call upon us to do it for them. Which is why the militia is integral and key as the ultimate check and balance. So when the Dick Act destroyed and actually violated the Constitution by changing literally the spirit of this whole system, then everything started changing dramatically. Because now, because by the early 1900s, the federal government was going to get away with doing all sorts of things. And nobody, we were so illiterate that they literally started creating the Department of Labor. There's nothing in the Constitution over labor. They were definitely involved in education. And they'd been involved in health care for, practically a century by that point in time. So the point is, folks, that when we look at how America evolved, we broke away. Common law in England, based on Blackstone's writings, his commentaries, the law, the foundation of the law, is the Bible in England, because it's a theocracy, and the specific Bible is the King James Version. When everybody said, we have to do that here, Madison kept saying, well, whose Bible are we going to use? And everybody wanted their Bible. And so at that point in time, at the ratification of the Constitution, 8 states had their own Bible. 8 states had their own theocracies, and they migrated away from it because the oppression was real in America. Religious oppression was still alive and well. There were Jews that were unable to practice openly and freely in Massachusetts until 1833, and so forth and so on. We made huge mistakes in allowing, I will just say, parasitical religious faiths to be able to openly practice in America, or even to exist in America. The framers were very clear that those types of faiths did not belong here. These ideological faiths that are antithetical to individual liberty and individual sovereignty. If that religion or that ideology does not support individual liberty, individual sovereignty, it cannot be harmonious in our society. Therefore, it's not going to be here. We're not going to allow those people to become citizens. They can't migrate here. Stay out. That was the paradigm, which is why it wasn't until the late 1800s, that Mohammedans were able to migrate to America. And this is all of a sudden when the federal government was able to start enforcing, and they took control over migration, and they started opening the door to allow these types of things to start, the enemy to live within. They have been waging these little cultural wars for well over a century, doing things that were absolutely antithetical to the framework of the Constitution. And as we look at common law in America, so let me get to this, because this is the whole point of trying to wrap this up today. When we look at common law in America, the Bible is not the law of the land. Remember, whose Bible? Whose Bible are we following? The Constitution became the supreme law of the land, and it declared it so, which means that all people must abide by that to respect your individual liberty and your individual sovereignty. All states are tied now by the 14th Amendment. They cannot pass, make, or enforce any law that abridges your privileges and immunities at all, not even for emergency purposes. Therefore, as we, you know, look at what common law is based upon, our common law system is a legal system that provides us justice based on the law itself that we establish as the common law. When the federal constitution was created, it was void of common law. Its legal jurisdiction was tied to its enumerated powers. So these are the things that the courts had jurisdiction over, not all things common law. Now, when the states started creating, or I should say, as the people and counties started creating new states, go look at the constitutions that those states created, or those county delegates created in establishing that state. They did not grant common law to the state courts and to the state government. Common law was maintained at the local level. Now, Thomas Jefferson, while he was the president, was being asked, you know, about details of this newfangled government and so forth. And he described the government as distributive of power. Political power is distributed to the closest government to the people, meaning the counties. That the state government was a general government, and the federal government was a very limited general government, but the state governments were limited as well. And if you looked at how the states behaved back then, they weren't in your knickers. They weren't creating roads. They didn't have infrastructure and those types of things. You know, people just created roads. And the necessity of that, the state started getting involved in maintaining or creating major roads or major thoroughfares so that people could get to D.C. and so forth and so on. As we look, that started to grow. As we saw government grow, not once did the legislature ever say that they are now establishing common law as the jurisdiction of the state government. Now, folks, most people think we got to do that. I'm here to tell you no. You want to maintain a general government at your state level, and you want to take back all the jurisdictions it shouldn't have that you believe you should have in your county. Because I believe most counties will agree it's better for the people locally to govern themselves than some fool hundreds of miles away that is being, you know, petitioned by a lobbyist that says, if your tread on your tire is this thin, then you have to buy new tires. Instead of allowing you to decide whether you should spend the money now or wait until you have a flat and then maybe repair the flat. But you have the course of action and the decision locally. But the state started actually creating laws like that. Here's the question. Is that law and is that authority actually delegated to your state to dictate when you have to buy products, whether it's for your car or anything else? And I'm here to tell you it's not. They're making up laws so that other people can make more money. And this is why we've had an economic warfare waged against us from the federal government all the way down. They've been assuming power. They've been assuming control. And common law is not one of those things. The interesting thing, and this is divine, The Lord ensured that there were some common law protections in the Constitution. One common law protection is in the Fifth Article, or the Fifth Amendment. Actually, it was the Seventh Article of the Bill of Rights. When you read the Fifth Amendment, no person shall stand in, you know, in jeopardy or stand in trial, be charged and be tried for a capital crime or an infamous crime unless he's been indicted by a grand jury. So if the charge is rape, if the charge is murder, if the charge is, you know, some infamous crime, you're going to spend some time in jail. Then they have to form a grand jury to indict that person. They don't use grand juries today. There's very few grand juries at the in the courts at the county level. Oh, because the judges and the lawyers, they don't want to pay to do that. That takes money out of their pocket. It inhibits their operational costs. The other protection of common law is the Seventh Amendment. And the Seventh Amendment basically says, in cases of common law, where the controversy is greater than $20, a traffic fine, a divorce, anything in common law that is greater than $20, let's just say a small claims court, where you have a dispute with your neighbor, and the issue is at hand, like, you know, the dealership, the particular dealership out in Dishman, California, or not Dishman, Washington, you know, damaged my car. The amount of the damage is $3,000, $4,000. But I have to go into small claims court, and a judge is going to decide that, where I have a right, because the controversy is greater than $20, to stand in front of a jury trial and let the jury decide whether Dishman is going to pay or not. Not a judge. That is a constitutional protected right. So the states are making and enforcing laws by not giving you access to jury trials. Do you want them to actually control common law? No, because they've already assumed common law controls, and this is what they've given us. This whole judiciary form of government, they're controlling everything. Everything goes into the courts, and they make all the decisions, which, my friends, is antithetical to a Republican form of government. We need to get littered on the Constitution. Obviously, there are really good things and there's real righteous things in trying to stand up against tyranny. I know the doctrine of magistrates, if you want to have a doctrine of magistrate, if you want to empower your sheriff instead of your other branches of government, such as your executive and your legislative body at the county level, then that's fine. As long as your Constitution is Republican in form, you can use the doctrine of magistrates. The problem is that there's no greater magistrate. You only have a lesser magistrate. There's no direct tie to a central magistrate because all states have all three branches of government. The federal government has all three branches. And your county, if you have all three branches, that is superior to then giving the power to one, the doctrine of magistrates, period. This is why we're going through these things in painstaking detail. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.